Shalom, everybody, and welcome to the Yishai Fleischer Show, broadcasting from Jerusalem to the world, and you're a part of it wherever you are. And indeed, right now, I'm in beautiful Jerusalem, in the heart of Jerusalem, in the Nachlaot neighborhood. You know what that means. That means if I'm in Nachlaot, I'm probably in Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov. And if I'm in Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov, I'm very likely with Rabbi Mike Foyer, who joins us here weekly for a spiritual cafe. However, Rabbi Mike, you've been a little absent.
I have been a little absent, but not in my heart. Just right. Logistically speaking.
Well, you had a celebration in the family.
We had a bat mitzvah. Our oldest daughter came of age. She's 12 now.
That's a huge mazal tov.
It's a very big thing. Thank you so much.
And not only did you have a bat mitzvah, but that also means that family flew in and
family,
all that.
Family, friends. It was an amazing celebration and an experiment in what it is to be a parent of someone who is actually now an adult. At least in the legal sense, and also, I would say, psycho-emotionally, well on the path.
Growing children. Tzar gidul banim. It's the pain of growing children. It's really not a simple thing, and we love our children so much, and we put so much into them. And yet, right next door is a completely different situation. Right within our midst and in our cities is growing this jihadist tendency amongst our Arab cousins. And I told a reporter the other day that it's like North Korea and South Korea. I live in South Korea, and right next door, I mean, the house next door is in North Korea. And it's almost never the twain shall meet. It's a scary, you're talking about growing a child. We're having very different visions about how to grow a child and what that future of that child is right now.
I think a lot of it has to do with whether we need to completely control in order to be who we want to be, or whether we're able to just let the world emerge through our lives. I mean, the whole view of the jihad is that everything's going to be okay. They have a, I would call it somewhat messianic vision, but only insofar as there's world dominance. And we as a people and we as a family culture understand the wisdom of saying, you'll never control. I can't control my daughter. I can't control the world. I can, however, influence, and I can bring out the things inside me that will actually make the world a place I want to live.
But we are commanded to push back on evil. Meaning to say we have to. There is a level of control. Like let's say you have an infestation in your house. It's not like c'est la vie. Well, that's the way it is, and I'll let it things emerge. You have to fumigate the place sometimes.
Well, no, it's not a passivity. That's not my point. My point is that we're able to deal with the contradiction, which demands action, certainly in the face of evil, and also demands the humility of understanding that the goal is not to order the world in some sort of simplistic, ideological fashion, but is rather to make it a place where God's spirit can come to rest.
There's also a lack of joy on the other side. It's really a joyless society. I saw it just this morning. My next-door neighbors just kind of gave me the fingers I was trying to pull out of the driveway of my neighborhood, and the tension is very palpable. And you mentioned this bat mitzvah and growing a child. This week's Torah portion, which is Toldot, is really about the two narratives that come out of these two children, Jacob and Esau and Esav. We'll use the Hebrew term Esav, but in English it's Esau and Jacob. We'll use the term Yaakov. And they're both going through their bar mitzvahs. They're both being born and then going through their bar mitzvahs. And we're really seeing, we meet these two characters. Unlike most, we're already getting a sense of their struggle in the womb. Mm-hmm. Not only that, one step further. They're actually not coming out into the world. The Rebecca is barren. Her and Isaac and Yitzchak are praying to God. God hears their prayers. He hears specifically Isaac's prayer because he's like a son of a righteous person, and his prayer is even, maybe more acceptable. In any case, they're praying. Our Midrash says on both sides of the room, in two corners of the room, they've got this kind of amazing power together, and they're praying for. She was barren for 20 years, and finally, the prayer is heard. And yet, there's some kind of struggle inside of her womb. So much so that she's aware of that struggle. She goes to get an answer, a prophetic answer, an understanding. What's going on? She senses this is not a physical pain. This is more. And when they when these two forces emerge, they emerge already in struggle, with Esau coming out first, and then Yaakov holding on, grabbing hold of the heel, and the symbolism is just it's a little scary, wouldn't you say?
I'm looking at the verse here, and I want to read it. It says, it's in the 25th chapter of Genesis in the 23rd line. V'yomer Adonai la shnei goyim bevitnech u'shnei lumim mime'ayich yiparedu u'le'um mile'um ye'amatz v'rav yavod ta'ir. It says, there are two nations within your womb, and two peoples are going to separate themselves out from your innards, and there will be a struggle between these two people, and the elder will serve the younger. Because that question of who's the elder brother is a central question in Yaakov and Esau's lives. It's a central question in the relationship of Am Yisrael to the nations of the world.
Well, why does that matter who the elder is?
Well, you know, traditionally in the ancient world, the elder had status because the elder essentially transforms the parents. Don't forget that. It's mm-hmm. you know, I mean, I just had this bat mitzvah, right? I always mm-hmm. tell my oldest daughter that her birthday is my birthday too, because I was born twice. I was born into the world as me, and then when she was born, I was born into the world as a parent, right? And if you think that's insignificant, one of the first statements of commitment that God makes in the Book of Exodus to the Jewish people, as opposed to the forefathers as individuals, is when he calls us B'ni B'chori Yisrael, my firstborn child Israel, which means that our birth as a people transforms God's relationship to creation, right? There's a new mode of relationship. So there's a power in not only in the ancient world, but in our story of that this is what's called peterechem, right? That the firstborn opens the way of the womb and therefore allows that whole new relationship to exist. At the same time, what I think I heard you saying is like, what difference does it make who's actually born first? Let's talk about who's the better person, who has the vision for what the world should be, right?
Or even more simply, live and let live. You do your thing, I'll do my thing. There's plenty of room for all of us. But later on, not even in this week's Torah portion, we'll see that there's they say amongst themselves, well, there's not enough room for both of us. This land is, you know, Esau has to leave because it's just... It cannot coexist.
Right. Well, listen, that question of whether we live in a consciousness of abundance or a consciousness of scarcity is a very big question, which runs through the whole Bible and certainly is a big question in the world we live in today. I mean, when we look at our cousins, you know, next door, the question is, do I require them to cease to exist in order that I can be? Do I have a scarcity of identity? In order for me to be me, do they have to not exist, or vice versa?
Well, I think they feel that way.
Oh, they're clear. I mean,
feel that our existence, given the way that they've structured their religion,
negates right. their vision of redemption and negates their relationship to the land, etc.
I think there's some truth in that, though.
I think it's
it complete, contests it. It contests their narrative.
So no question, but I think it's complete falsehood in so far that identity is never dependent upon another person.
Unless you've structured your identity to be like, I am supreme, I am superior, I'm God's chosen. And guess what? It was Ishmael who went up to the Temple Mount with Abraham and not Isaac. So if your narrative is that, and then the redemptive force that is bringing the Jewish people back to the land of Israel is happening, that strikes at you.
Yeah, but we as Jews also have to stay focused on our question. Have we fallen into the same trap? Meaning, are we making the mistake of building our identity, our return to our land, our ability to realize redemption, is that dependent upon negating? You know, is it dependent upon the Arabs not existing?
This is a tension between how you and I always understand things. And there, I think there is an element of that because, for example, the seven nations were commanded to be evicted from this land or eradicated, meaning to say
absolutely.
They stood in the way. And you cannot, for example, a lot of times the media says to me when they stand on my porch, they say to me, well, what's going to be right there? And they point to the Temple Mount. And they understand that, you know, they try to sometimes say to me, can there be a mosque and a temple at the same time? Can we work it out? And I say to them, the only way we can work it out is if like the Muslims will come to some kind of conclusion that this is to their benefit, part of their narrative. But on the whole, no. As it stands right now, they're two opposite forces.
See, I think that the difference is between the Book of Devarim and the Book of Isaiah. You know, you're absolutely correct. If you look in the Book of Devarim, the only role that the nations play, the seven nations in particular, but they're the only nations referenced really in the Book of Devarim, is get out of the way or die. Right, the entrance of Am Yisrael into the land is dependent upon negation of the seven nations. it's amazing that the book of Isaiah opens up a completely new chapter in our relationship to the nations of the world. Not only are we meant to be a light unto the nations, which means that in order for our light to benefit the world, they have to be enlightened by it. But I think the answer to this reporter's question about the Beit HaMikdash is, well, Isaiah already answered your question. Beiti Beit Tfilah Yikare Lekol Amim. My house will be called a house of prayer for all people. Our goal, our role, our responsibility as the Jewish people is to make it my house, meaning it has to be to God. There can't be any mistake about that. And when it is, it'll be a house of prayer for all people.
Let me tell you exactly how it went down.
Mm-hmm.
It was Channel 2. A very famous reporter named Danny Kushmaro mm-hmm. was at my house. And here's the way he phrased the question. He said, if that thing blows up, would you cry?
That's just a setup. Come on.
Right, that was a setup. Now, check out how I answered. I said, no, I won't cry. But maybe, who says it has to blow up? Maybe the Arabs, for example, will help us build the Beit HaMikdash. Maybe it'll be converted into part of the Beit HaMikdash. I said, he cut that part out.
Oh, yeah?
He only stuck in the part that said, no, I won't be sad.
Right.
And just interesting that, like, sometimes that version of a more, you know, holistic kind of a way of thinking and talking, that's not acceptable to the news.
Oh, it's not acceptable. That's how we got in this predicament in the first place, because the whole question of the Temple Mount is not acceptable in general. That's why in 67 our military and national leadership were more than happy to hand the keys back to the Muslim authorities, because they didn't want to deal with it. And now in the same way, they don't want to hear someone who they want to characterize as a radical danger to stability say, wow, you know, maybe there is a way we could actually do this together.
By the way, not everybody in the military leadership was for that. There were many, even in key positions, who were against that, wanted to actually put a Jewish military base up there at the where the Antonia Fortress was. That was Uzi Narkis, and it was Moshe Dayan that wanted this give run away from the reality of the Temple Mount. So there were people there, even secular people, who saw things differently, but they just... It turned out that the guy who was really, really, really in charge made the wrong call. Okay, so they come out of the womb. They're growing up. There's a tension between them. And the first interchange that we have of them is this famous red lentil soup business, right? So, you know, Jacob, he is a man of the tents. He's a simple man. Esav is a hunter. He's a hunter-gatherer. He's man of the field. He's a manly man. He's a manly man. You know, he's bow and arrow man. He's, you know, he's out there. And Yitzchak, his father, he likes that side of Esav. He's a man who can dominate this world.
Mm-hmm.
He ain't no sissy or pushover. But Rivka, who herself is no sissy or pushover, you see it throughout. She loves Yaakov, and the term that's used in the Bible is one that's like eternal. She loves one for Isaac. It's he loved, but Rivka's love is eternal for Yaakov. Any case, they meet up in a little setup. The setup is who's the setter upper? Is it Esau? Is it Esav? The tough guy. We don't hear that he's the setup master, but it's Jacob, Yaakov, who is like the Jewish brother, right? Turns out he's waiting for Esav at the edge of the field. Esav is coming back home. He is starving. And the descriptions are that he was really starving. He's just dying to eat. And Yaakov makes a deal with him. He says, sure, I'll feed you from this delicious soup which I prepared. I happen to be standing here on the side of the road preparing this delicious food. And the smell must be just too much for Esav, who's more kind of animalistic. And instead of feeding his brother, here, have a nice meal, my good brother. I've prepared this for you. He wants to extract a concession. And that concession is that I want the birthright, says Jacob. I want the birthright. I want to be called number one. And at that moment, Esav says, well, I'm about to lose my life. Who cares about the birthright? It's just ephemeral. And that's a recurring theme. Like, ephemeral things don't mean anything to me. I'm a man of action. I'm a man of the field. I'm in this world. Otherworldly things don't concern me. These are theoreticals. Give me the soup now and forget this theoretical, meaningless thing about birthright. And so the first interchange happens. Jacob feeds him. According to the Midrashim, he actually like pours the soup down his throat. He serves him. You know, he's almost servile to him. But he gets the birthright, which is going to come back to bite Esav. So what is that about? What is Jacob's trickiness about? What is that relationship about? Where's the love? Where's the feed your brother, man? Where's honor your older brother? Where's that? Instead, trying to usurp.
Listen, this is a consistent theme in Yaakov's life. And it goes to the heart of his name. I mean, Yaakov, it means ankle. It means a heel, you know, ekev. But that very word itself means crooked. Right? And in his whole life, he's constantly struggling to figure out how to do the right thing. And yet presented with situations where going in the roundabout fashion gives him the advantage. And ultimately, his name is changed. You know, God willing, we'll speak about in a number of weeks. And his name is changed to Yisrael, right? Which, if you split the two words, or the one word into two, Yisrael means Yashar El, means straight to God. Yaakov's in a process of straightening himself out. Esau just is what he is. And I don't know that I really feel the need to defend this type of behavior between the brothers. I mean, you've got siblings, yes?
Sure.
Right, and especially as the younger brother myself, right?
I'm the older brother.
I see. Oh, we can have this conversation, but I can tell you that the posture of the younger brother is, how do I work within the situation as given in order to get to where I am, as opposed to the assumption I find often in the older brother is the older brother proceeds, they define the situation, and I think that this is the difference in the worldviews we're dealing with here.
But what does it mean, the birthright? What does that mean? It really is an ephemeral thing. One of us is the firstborn, although it is important to understand they're twins, and the separation between their first birth is very, you know, very
thin.
That's right, very thin. But what does that mean? I came out first, or I'm the firstborn. What could that mean?
Well, I mean,
why would you want that?
The sages point out very quickly is that in the ancient world, the firstborn was the priest of the household. Mm-hmm. Right? The divine service, the service of God, always passed through the hands of the firstborn until much later in the story when it's taken away from the firstborn and given to the Levites for the children of Israel. But in that sense, Yaakov's saying, I don't need to dominate the physical situation of this world. I want to serve its purpose. Right? And the purpose, and this is one of the great wisdoms of the Torah, is that purpose generally emerges after process. Right? This is this phrase, Sof Maaseh B'Machshava Tchila. It may be the last thing that I do, but it was my original intention. So Esav is focused on, this is the way the world is. I'm hungry. I need to eat. What is this guy talking about that he's going to serve God and at some point, some divine promise? Like you said, it's not just that it's ephemeral. It doesn't exist. It has to emerge out of the situation. And Esav says, what are you talking about, emerge? I'm in control of the situation as it is. If I need something, I go get it. If I want to be in charge, I fight a battle. Right? And Yaakov says, well, no, I want to actually be in the position so when the opportunity to bring the divine spirit in the world presents itself, that I'm there.
Right. So I would phrase that in a way that I think most people could understand, is that Esav is material. He's materially focused, and he, in a sense, denies the spiritual side of things.
I think that's half what I'm saying. But the other half is that Yaakov is fully engaged in the material world. That's why he's so deceptive. He just understands that the material is the
medium.
The medium.
Right.
From which the meaning will emerge.
Right. In some sense, I think the Torah is trying to tell us this Jacobian, Yaakovian sneakiness is actually his effort to be Esav-like. It's like, okay, and we'll see at the end of the Torah portion, we'll get to in a second, I've got to put on the Esav clothes in this world and play the game, but in order to get a completely different goal, and that goal is spirituality and bringing, you know, God into this world, but I can't wrestle you in a physical wrestling match, but I can wrestle you in other ways in this lower domain, and through that good things will come, but I have to. It's like it's Esav's world. It's Esav's world.
It's a physical world.
It's a physical world. It's a material world. And so I have to play the game, and I'm a material forefather. But I have to master that to some extent in order to bring this ephemeral spiritual goal into this world.
Yeah, because we as Jews do not believe that spirituality is something which exists outside the world. There's no soul-body split from Israel. That's actually a Greek notion which Christianity brought forward through history, interestingly enough, because of the relationship between Esav and Yaakov in the rabbinic mind plays itself out in the relationship between Israel and Christianity, right? So if there's no soul-body split, then actually the spirit emerges from the body, but you got to get it there. It's not either or. It's how do I work with this body in order to get it to the point where it can express the soul? And that's what Yaakov's trying to do. And let's remember, he's young, he's confused. Nobody told him how or what. And that's why it's his mother in the end of the day that's got to lead the way.
Right. We're going to talk about the mamas in just a second. And this is a good opportunity to take a little break. I want to thank so much Jack for helping us make this show possible in honor of his wife Lillian and his sister Sarah, who are just great helpers of the cause. I want to thank you so much. And I want to thank the Michel family as well. Folks, when you're out there and helping the cause, it just makes such a difference. Time and money and effort. It takes a lot in order to make these thoughts emerge into the world and to bring them down. And for me personally, just to meet up with Rabbi Mike and get it all done and put it up for you, it all takes effort. And your help really, not only does it help materially, but it also helps spiritually in that it gives me a sense that to go on and to push forward. So I want to thank you so much. And I want to bless Lillian and Sarah, that Hashem should take them on their spiritual journey. And all those who listen, I hope that you're on a journey, but not a journey to think about this or that or to decide between things. A journey for that goal in order to attain God's dream in this world. So you are listening to the Yishai Fleisher Show. I'm here with Rabbi Mike Foyer, Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov. Short break. We'll be right back. And we're back here on the Yishai Fleisher Show. Rabbi Mike Foyer, I join him in his Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov. Beautiful Nachlaot, Israel. It's been raining for the past few days, but now the sun has broken through a little bit. We're learning the Torah portion of Toldot, which is a tense Torah portion, as most of them are, really. Tense and intense, a tense birth of these two forces, Esav and Yaakov, tense times between Yitzchak and his Philistine neighbors. They're always damming up and filling up the wells that he digs. They've got this bad attitude about resources, and they fill in wells that he has found. So that is such a that is, and they filled in the wells that his father's Abraham dug, and just that thought, I sometimes think about that, like that is the exact opposite of creativity. It's like and I see it with our cousins here, our neighbors, and there's a damming up of goodness. There's putting trash on beautiful things in life and in physicality on the ground, and there's a darkness in the Torah portion there, but Yitzchak is able to come out of it, and he's able to find this well. He finds 100 gates. He's successful that year. And the Torah says about him that he continues to kind of be blessed and successful. He's able to somehow come to peace, come to terms with his Philistine neighbors. They sign a pact. They recognize Beersheba as being a Jewish city, shall we say. And then there's this recurring tension between Esav and Yaakov, in what we talked about, the famous Red Lentil episode, and then in the infamous trickery, the biggest trick of the Bible, and that is the dressing up of Jacob, of Yaakov, in Esav's clothes. Dun, dun, dun. Go to your blind father, says Rivka, the mother of Yaakov. Go to your blind dad, and he's about to pass away. And he's giving out blessings, so I need you to sneak in there. He wants to give the blessing to your brother, I need you to sneak in there and take the blessings for yourself. I mean, it's Shakespearean.
or the opposite. Shakespeare read his Bible.
Right, exactly. But it's a drama of epic proportions.
This is high drama. And I think it's important to just note at the outset that there's a parallel between what Rivka does and what Sarah did before her, which is that apparently there's an inability on the behalf of Abraham or Yitzchak to see clearly who it is that would inherit the blessing and carry out God's will in the world. Because Sarah says very clearly up front to Abraham, no, not Yishmael, Yitzchak.
Right, but it's not her son.
True.
Right? So
true.
She could
so this
say,
is even closer to the bone.
She could say, take that, take the Egyptian
servant
and kick her out of the house.
Nevertheless, Abraham, it is Abraham's son. And so right. Abraham listens to her.
Right. Right.
Abraham's firstborn son.
Through great pain. Through great pain, he listens to
her.
No,
but my point is this is all about clarity of vision.
Right.
Because it's not for naught that the Torah introduces this whole episode saying that Yitzchak is blind.
Right.
And you know, like it says he's blind because he's old. But you know what the Midrash says? You know what the sage said about that? Why was he blind? Because when he was bound to the altar about to be killed, right, that the angels above were weeping and that their tears fell into his eyes and blinded him. That he's been blind since then. Now, what on earth does that mean? Right? I think part of what it means is the intensity of Yitzchak's experience. I mean, he was completely given over. The fact that he is alive now is basically by the grace of God only. That blinds him to the more nuanced, complicated realities of what it is to try to grow a family in the world. He is blind to that. Therefore, he looks at Esau, who is much more the, I'm going to dominate the world.
Grounded.
Yes, and just make this happen. And he says, well, that must be where we're going. And Rivka, who has a vision of what these two children are like together, from her flesh, literally.
And she's coming from a house of idolatry. She knows
knows the world very well. Her brother is the ultimate deceiver, as we'll see in coming weeks. Right?
And she realizes that Esav is going in this path of idolatry in a dark way. She wants her son Yaakov, the spiritual one, to get the blessings.
She also realizes on the deeper level that the ability to build the world is not the same as the ability to bring out its meaning.
Mm-hmm.
The two have to come together.
Right.
And they do come together in that ultimate realization that Yitzchak has, even though he's blind, he doesn't know what he's saying, when, you know, Yaakov comes in and his mother convinces him to cover his arms with animal skin so he feels hairy like his brother, and he's wearing Esau's clothes so that he smells like his brother. And yet Yitzchak senses there's something strange going on, and he says this famous line, which just echoes down through the generations, HaKol Kol Yaakov V'Hayadayim Yidei Esav. Right? The voice is the voice of Yaakov. The hands are the hands of Esav.
It's interesting, though, the smell is also the smell of Esav. Or no, it doesn't say the smell of Esav. No, it does not say it. It says the smell of the field.
Right.
The smell of the field.
And which field is that?
Well, some people say it's the field of the Machpelah.
The cave of the patriarchs.
Right.
Right. It could also be the field that he went out, Yitzchak went out to pray in.
That's what I heard the Midrash is, that he went out to pray in that field.
Yes.
In the field of Machpelah. That's what I heard.
Where the field is an open question. I don't want to let your new job interfere with your interpretation of the sages.
I heard that as it's in the same parsha that he was, because remember that Ephron sold the field as well.
Right.
And so that's the same Sadeh.
It is, and I can bring you, if you're interested, later a number of Midrashim that make an incredible connection, both physical and spiritual, between Hebron and the Cave of the Patriarchs and the Temple Mount. But the point I'm making is that in that moment when Yitzchak had that experience of hearing Yaakov's voice but feeling Esau's hands, he realized that that is ultimately the ideal of the world. Mm-hmm. Is that yeah, you know what? There takes a certain aspect of humanity to build the world. And there takes a certain aspect of humanity to speak its voice. Right? And the power of the Jewish people is actually not primarily in our ability to build the world, although we have a great merit of living in a time where we're showing that, of course, we can do that. It's not that we can't do it. We can do it as well as anybody else. It's just not our primary characteristic.
Right.
We build the world in order to give a platform for our voice to speak its truth.
One could say that in diaspora, the Jewish people were really the voice of Jacob. But as Zionism and the redemption, the return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel, there's an additional aspect, which is the hands are the hands of Esav. Mm. Meaning to say, we have now a return to the hands of Esav, to knowing how to fight, knowing how to till the land, and knowing how to build the world and innovate and all the stuff that we're doing, the startup nation, the whole business. And that's, by the way, that's just parenthetically, that's become like a semi-religion in Israel, startup world.
It's a replacement for it.
Right. Right, but you know what? It's better. I'll take that over some of the other replacements. Meaning, it's a very creative impulse, and there's a
I think we're in the phase of needing to re-embody ourselves.
Right, and so that embodiment—that's an Esavian type of
perspective
with the voice of Jacob.
Yeah,
and maybe that voice of Jacob has yet to come out fully.
I think it absolutely does, because the way you talk when you're wandering the streets is not the same way you speak when you're sitting in your home.
Right.
And we haven't actually learned what it feels like to be at home and speak in that voice. As we were speaking about before the show, one of our great problems as a people is we actually don't even know how to speak to each other, much less how to speak to the world from the perspective of, no, we are at home. We're so used to being wanderers and being Yaakov in the sense that I got to think, I'm looking at you right now, and I know what I want to say, but I'm going to have to think about how you're going to take it. And so I want to say what I want to say in light of how I think you're going to respond. That's how you speak when you're a visitor.
Right.
When you're a wanderer. But when you're in your own home, I know when I have guests in my home, of course I'm welcoming and considerate, but there's a point at which when I speak Torah, I speak from where I am and who I am. And not necessarily in light of how it's going to be received. And that's that Kol Yaakov that we're waiting for.
It's hard for the Jewish people to feel embodied. We've been disembodied for a long time. And in a lot of ways, and I think the Maharal also says this, that basically there's a truth to that this is an Esavian world. This is the world of Esav. And that we are kind of foreigners. In some way, we are foreigners. We are kind of interlopers trying to be birthed into this world, trying to hold on to the heel of Esav, trying to get the birthright, trying to get the blessings and kind of bringing them in. And there's a war for that, even within ourselves, but certainly, you know, against the world. And that battle continues. That battle is also the return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel, the embodiment, and that voice, which is right now, I think, very ambivalent. It's not that voice of Jacob, and it's really not, we'll learn about it later, there's one word for when the Jewish people have the hands of Esav and have their true voice and can do it all, that's called Israel. Mm-hmm. And we have yet to fully manage that, but we're certainly on the way. But we're out of time. Rabbi Mike Foyer, Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov, Spiritual Cafe, Jerusalem, broadcasting to the world on the Yishai Fleischer Show. Thank you so much.
It is my pleasure. I love it. It's a good conversation.
Folks, I want to thank you so much for your help. And please pray that Rabbi Mike and I, we're both busy folks. It's so important that we get a chance to sit together. So please pray that we're able to continue to broadcast for you. And we certainly want to. And we hope and we think that Hashem wants that. Also, God bless all of you out there. Stay tuned, stay strong, and stay connected. And shalom. Shafti yechvutami, shafti yechvutami, shafti yechvutami Yisrael. Shafti yechvutami, shafti yechvutami, shafti yechvutami Yisrael.